Welcome to Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian. This is Volume 4, Number 7, released on March 31st, 2006. In this episode of Spotlight, we'll learn why sugar is bad for the oceans, that the world's most famous nomads were rather urbane, why you should never judge a dwarf galaxy by size alone, and how past nuclear testing illuminates the skeletons in our closets. Now here's David Evans, the Smithsonian Undersecretary for Science, to put some flesh on the bones of this edition of Spotlight.
In this installment of the Spotlight podcast, we travel to Panama to learn how a researcher at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute has discovered the surprising impact of sugar compounds on coral reef ecology. From there, we're off to the lonely plains of Mongolia, where National Museum of Natural History anthropologists have unearthed evidence that complex urban centers were integral to the power of the Mughal Empire. Back at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we'll take a peek at dim dwarf galaxies and hear how astronomers are peering into the undernourished stellar dust in the hopes of discovering the keys to the formation of our own complex and resource-abundant galaxy. And our last foray takes us to the forefront of forensic medicine, where Smithsonian anthropologists are focusing on the more recently deceased. Natural history researchers are showing how the radioactive remnants of mid-20th century nuclear bomb testing inadvertently provides a radioactive clock that starts ticking in our bones as soon as death occurs.
First, to the Smithsonian Tropical Research Center in Panama, where David Klein studies the stresses that abound for corals. Complex coral reef ecosystems around the globe are under such severe attack that scientists have a hard time simply figuring out which of the many threats is most fearsome. Reefs are extremely diverse, and symbiotic relationships abound, confounding cause and effect relationships. While scientists have long suspected that phosphates, nitrates, and ammonia found in the agricultural runoff and sewage associated with coastal development contributes to reef loss, Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute marine biologist David Klein has uncovered a new menace, sugars. Klein, a researcher at the Bocas del Toro Research Station in Panama, conducted a large-scale ecotoxicology study in Caribbean coral reefs, using a custom-designed and built dosing system that allowed him to test the effects of 40 different chemicals on 400 replicate corals in each experiment. When he exposed the corals to nitrates and phosphates, he found 7% mortality rate among the corals. However, when he presented carbon compounds in the form of simple sugar molecules to the corals, nearly 35% of them died. Klein has found that, unlike other chemicals, sugar leads to an explosive growth of normally symbiotic bacteria, disrupting the balance between the healthy coral and its associated bacterial community, leading to disease and death in the coral. The question now is whether these lab findings are applicable to real-life situations. According to Klein, corals are already under stress from warming waters and loss of fish and urchins that eat the algae that competes with the corals for space. With weakened defenses, simply boosting the growth rate of the symbiotic bacteria with the influx of sugar may be enough to push corals over the edge. If the findings hold, it will show that monitoring carbon levels in reef areas may be critical to slowing the loss of these invaluable ecosystems. Now to Mongolia, where natural history anthropologists are hoping to settle the question, just how nomadic were the world's most famous nomads? The Mongol Empire, founded by Genghis Khan, was the largest contiguous empire in human history. Scholars have regarded Mongol empires as being nomadic, highly mobile political confederations. However, recent research suggests otherwise. In the December 2005 article Urban Centers and the Emergence of Empires in Eastern Inner Asia, published in Antiquity, Smithsonian Museum of Natural History Department of Anthropology Chair Daniel Rogers and colleagues Erdenabat Ulambayar and Matthew Gallen report on their discoveries regarding the inner mechanics of Mongol empires. Contrary to earlier interpretations, Rogers' American-Mongolian team found that the large political confederations which characterized the great Mongol empires of the 1st and 2nd millennia AD actually had urban centers that provided central points of trade, administration, agriculture, craftsmanship, and military operations. These centers made use of highly sophisticated urban places that featured advanced planning and design, and impressive monuments that served a variety of functions. The center included open spaces within the walls, reserved for tent neighborhoods, and the development of extensive irrigation systems beyond the city walls. Rogers' study demonstrates that past interpretations of the Mongol empires have overemphasized the nomadic aspects of the economy. Now to the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, where astronomers are trying to solve the riddle of dwarf galaxy chemistry. Our own Milky Way is a normal galaxy with roughly 100 billion stars. By comparison, a dwarf galaxy is quite small and may have as few as only 100,000 stars. This small number of stars makes dwarf galaxies very much dimmer than normal ones and much harder to study. Dwarf galaxies are also peculiar in that they seem to have a drastically smaller amount of elements, heavier than hydrogen and helium, such as carbon, oxygen, or nitrogen. A few extreme dwarfs, for example, have relative abundances of elements compared to hydrogen that are only about 5% of the values found in our solar system. The reasons for this are not understood, but then neither are the reasons for the very existence of dwarf galaxies. Nevertheless, dwarf galaxies are thought to be important for two principal reasons. The first is that normal galaxies, including the Milky Way, may have evolved from the gradual merging of many dwarf galaxies. Thus, dwarf galaxies may hold a clue to the early life of the Milky Way. The second is that the heavier elements are essential to life, and scientists trying to understand better how the congenial environment of Earth developed want to understand why some places are rich in such heavy elements, while others are not. Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory astronomers Jessica Rosenberg, Matt Ashby, and Jaisheng Huang, together with a colleague, have studied a set of 19 dwarf galaxies that are known to be producing at least some new stars. The team used the Spitzer Space Telescope and its infrared array camera to study the properties of the warm dust in these galaxies. This dust is heated by young stars and is bright at infrared wavelengths. In a recent article in the Astrophysical Journal, the astronomers report that these dwarf galaxies are striking in their diversity of appearance in the infrared. Some seem to be deficient in dust and lacking in star formation activity, even when taking into account a possible deficiency of heavy elements. Others, although they are dwarfs in size, are as active in producing stars and heating up dust as much bigger normal systems. Now that astronomers realize there is a wide diversity of types, and have begun to characterize the nature of those differences, they plan to try to study more closely the key parameters in order to understand the origins of the diversity and any implications they may have for the Milky Way and its stars. And finally, back in Washington, D.C., National Museum of Natural History anthropologists are honing the science of radiocarbon dating recent human remains. Forensic anthropologists study skeletal remains to identify individuals and examine evidence used to determine the cause of death. It's sometimes difficult to determine how long an individual has been deceased from skeletal remains. Because radiocarbon, 14C, is incorporated into all living things, including human bones, radiation from a bomb pulse can serve as an isotopic chronometer, or instrument to measure time, for the past half century. Testing of nuclear weapons during the 1950s and early 1960s doubled the level of radiocarbon in the atmosphere, 14CO2. Bomb curve radiocarbon dating has given rise to a method of analysis forensic anthropologists can use to determine the time of death for skeletal remains. From its peak in 1963, the level of atmospheric 14 CO2 has decreased exponentially, with a mean life of about 16 years. Not because of radioactive decay, but because of mixing with large marine and terrestrial carbon reservoirs. The absence of bomb radiocarbon in skeletonized human remains generally indicates a date of death before 1950. Comparison of the radiocarbon values with the post-1950 bomb curve may also help clarify when in the post-1950 era the individual was still alive. Artificially high values clearly indicate the individual's alive in the post-1950 era. A recent article by National Museum of Natural History anthropologist Douglas Ubelacher and colleague B.A. Buchholz analyzes the complexities in the use of bomb curve radiocarbon to determine time since death of human skeletal remains. Interpretations of these data must consider possible significant differences between the time of bone formation and levels of atmospheric radiocarbon at the time of death, as estimated ages or dates of individual tissues may lag actual age at death. This relationship appears to be influenced by diet, medical treatment, growth and remodeling patterns, age at death of the individual, type of tissue sampled, regional variations of 14C concentrations, and other factors. That's all for this issue of Spotlight on Science at the Smithsonian. If you haven't already subscribed to the Spotlight podcast, visit spotlight.si.edu to learn how. You can also download archived editions of Spotlight. As always, feel free to share your thoughts with the Spotlight team at spotlight@si.edu.